I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/thrive for 20% off your first order. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hi, I'm Chanti.
And I'm Lynx, and you're listening to Muses.
Enjoy the show.
Hi there.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
So am I, yeah. We're Muses. We're the podcast all about women in rock. And we just had an amazing interview, our first of the year.
We did. We chatted with Dee Dee Keel.
Yeah.
Now, if that name sounds familiar, it's possible that she's come up in your Google searches of famous groupies.
Yeah.
Or perhaps you've read her chapter in Pamela DeBar's Let's Spend the Night Together.
Yeah. Dee Dee worked at the Whiskey A Go-Go for 13 years. She told us about her experiences there. We got to talk to her about growing up in Venice Beach and seeing the Doors come to be. She's got some interesting Jim Morrison things that I didn't know about, so that was a cool one.
That story floored me.
Oh, so good.
I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so she worked at the Whiskey A Go-Go right at the time that, baby, you'd want to be working there. Like, it was right place, right time.
Yeah.
Right attitude, as we said. Yeah, so she told us about seeing Pamela DeBar on the Sunset Strip when she was with the GTOs, like in her full GTO, what do you call that?
Splendor.
Splendor.
Yeah.
And she just watched and she found inspiration from her. And then they met years later.
So cool. So cool. And yeah, she told us some other great groupie stories.
Being in the Led Zeppelin kind of
And she gave us a little tips for bagging them if you're looking for some. It was a great interview. And thank you so much, Dee Dee. It's exciting. She mentioned possibly a book in the future. So you get some stories here, and I can't wait to hear even more stories.
Yeah, she's got them in spades. Yeah. So we're bringing you another interview with another incredible woman who was there, who saw it, who loved,
lived, loved, and is still just all about music. True fan, true music soul right there.
Incredible.
Yeah.
We hope you enjoy it.
Hi, Dee Dee.
Hi there. Nice to hear your voice.
Nice to hear yours. Thank you so much for doing this with us. We're very excited to be chatting with you.
Well, I'm very, very pleased to do it.
Yeah, and hopefully we can meet when we come to LA as well.
Absolutely. We have to take that trip up the canyon.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah. Excited.
How was your weekend last weekend at the, is it pronounced NAMM? NAMM?
It's NAMM. And Guitars has been kind enough to host me. So I go and help out and hang out. And boy, you can't go there without turning around and seeing some rock stars. It's a pretty exciting and exhausting weekend.
Sounds like a little bit of groupie heaven.
It kind of is. My feet don't think so. My feet and legs said, let's stop already. I usually just go on Saturday and Sunday, which of course is the worst for traffic inside that convention hall. And it's grown. It's about four levels now where it used to be just one floor. But very exciting.
It's really interesting now how conventions are a thing and people can go and meet their favorite rock star. It's this new way of...
And that's... Yeah, so that's not really the purpose of these, but of course, it's a groupie's haven when you want to go find out, you know, get closer and find out where these people are. They're always in one spot there, so they're easy to find.
I heard Jackson Brown was there a few years ago.
So many people, but I'll tell you now, I being a good groupie, I always figure the ins and outs. So now I figured out the days to go to NAMM are not the weekend. They're the beginning. The big stars show up on the Thursday and Friday when it's less trafficked so that they can get in and out. So there's your ticket.
Oh, good hot tip there.
Yeah, we live, and I know our listeners live for the insider groupie tips and knowledge. So that's wonderful. Coming off hot right off the bat, Dee Dee.
I know I was laughing because there was a little question that you had about tricks of the trade. That one made me laugh.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when we kind of open up questions to listeners, sometimes it's like, what advice can you give to? And then it's just like fill in the blanks, you know? And
yeah, people want to
know. Times have changed. The tactics or the techniques that we had back in the 60s and 70s don't necessarily work today, but they don't necessarily not work. So, you know, you got to try everything.
Well, Dee Dee, I don't know if you know this, but Lynx and I actually met in Pamela DeBar's writing workshop, and Lynx was the girl in Toronto who brought Pamela here to start her writing workshops. And so we first read your story in her book, Let's Spend the Night Together, and we're wondering, how did you and Pamela meet?
Well, Pamela and I were in Hollywood on the Sunset Strip at the same time during the late 60s and all through the 70s. She was part of I call it a gypsy troupe. They entertained on the strip. It was Susie Cream Cheese and Vito and this whole camp of really cool characters. I just watched them. When she became part of Frank Zappa's family in one of the GTOs, I really began to follow her around. But we never officially met until just before the interviews for Let's Spend the Night Together. And it was funny because she was amazed to hear my tales of her escapades in Hollywood. So it was really fun.
That's interesting when, you know, it's such a small scene, but big at the same time. And you do come across people, but they're just not in your little circle, but you're still
right.
Aware of them and everything. I imagine.
Right. And I was young. I was able to go from my hometown of Venice Beach up on a bus. My grandparents, both sets, lived in Hollywood. So Hollywood was a kind of my stomping grounds anyway. But to be able to see Pamela DeBar and the GTOs and just flamboyantly strutting down the strip, of course, I followed. They were like the Pied Piper. So, you know, absolutely. I became really, really enthusiastic about wanting to be just like her.
Yeah, they would be hard to miss walking down the strip together, frolicking.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you also worked on the strip, right? At the Whiskey-A-Go-Go, is that where it's on? If you could tell us about, you know, the history of the whiskey, your history with it, your relationship with the venue. I imagine working there must have been just so special.
Well, looking back on it, yes. Of course, you know, when you're in it, you don't realize it's just a job. But I actually began hanging around outside the whiskey not too long after it opened in 64. But there was an age limit. I was only 14. I was too young to get in. But I realized that I could stand outside and I could hear the bands and watch them load their equipment in and out. So I just hung out for a long time, just watching those bands going in and out, and met up with a few of my idols. So in 1969, my high school girlfriend, the two of us that hung around outside, she actually got a job in the box office. So I was able to get in at that point to see shows, and I'd get in for free. The owner, Elmer Valentine, he began asking about me. Soon after that, he walked up and asked, would you like to answer phones for a couple of weeks? And I thought, well, heck yeah. So I went up to do that, and he realized that I had a lot of knowledge of bands on a street level. Eventually, I was able to help him out by suggesting billboards on the side of the building. I was bringing him money. So he gave me some time, like a Monday night and off night, to book some of my favorite bands. And it just rolled on like that for about 12, 13 years.
That's amazing. So it's almost like a part of you chose the rock and roll life and a part of the rock and roll life chose you.
It was fate for sure.
That does sound about right. Yeah, I think, you know, if you have a love, a passion for something, and you put yourself in the right place, eventually you'll work your way right in there. And that's exactly what happened for me.
You said you worked there 12 years?
About 13, almost 13, yeah.
Wow.
Long time.
Well, did the industry change in that time? Were you, you know, involved?
Radically.
Yeah.
It radically changed. Yeah, over time it changed. I mean, the whiskey closed down a couple of times. We turned into a cabaret house. We had, you know, a lot of ups and downs. I mean, eventually what happened was Elmer, my boss, had come and said, we'd open the Rainbow Bar and Grill. We'd open the Roxy. There was a time when I'd answer phones out of the whiskey office and flip a switch, and I'd be literally picking up the phone and answering a Whiskey A Go-Go, Roxy Theater, back and forth, and we were swamp booking both. But as the music industry changed and the record companies pulled out support and they weren't having a lot of parties and spending a lot of money, the whiskey was having struggles. So we picked up our whiskey office and moved down to the Roxy into a little tiny cubbyhole, and I kind of saw the writing on the wall, and at the time I was deciding to get married, settle down, and I ended up marrying a rock guy and touring the world. So mm-hmm. I gave up the whiskey but opened up another avenue for myself to continue my love of music and bands and traveling.
Ooh, I'm loving this so much. I just, you know, it just never gets old hearing these stories. We're, you know, 125 episodes in and we haven't had like a real conversation about a really legendary music venue before with somebody who's worked there. And then, yes, this is, I'm really enjoying this so far.
Oh, I'm so glad.
So we're definitely not the only people who find you completely fascinating and who almost want to live vicariously through you because things have changed so much. Our listeners are primarily women and a range of ages, it yeah. seems, who are still so interested in the groupie legacy, in your groupie mm-hmm. legacy. There mm-hmm. are Pinterest sites dedicated to, if you Google your name, you'll come up on these Pinterest sites and the who dated who and groupie blog WordPresses and they're blogs of celebration. What do you think the fascination with groupie culture, what do you think is so special about it that it has lived on even into 2020?
Well, I think the general public has always had intrigue with celebrities. And I remember in the 1950s buying movie star magazines. We would just sit around with these magazines, my girlfriends and I, at the age of, you know, 10 to 12, just eating up the articles, trying on the hairstyles, trying to buy the fashion. I think with groupies, there was a shift to the public, seeing girls who had infiltrated the other side of the stage curtain, so to speak, were able to get close to their idols. when that happened and they were seen in photos and they became famous in some fashion. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting too, because so many women groupies, were inspirational. They were muses, not only to the rock star, but then their photos are in these magazines and suddenly they're muses to, you know, girls like us.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's it. Once you see someone in a photo, I mean, look what happened when the Beatles started showing up with Patti Boyd and Jane Asher. And, you know, we all want to have that hair and that style. And, you know, so my love kind of switched over from the movie star magazines into the 16s and the Teen Beat and that kind of thing. Couldn't get enough of that.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think that's why it's kind of lived on.
We wanted to ask you about your childhood. You mentioned you grew up in Venice. That sounds amazing, Venice Beach.
Yeah.
What was that like? And when did music become a main factor in your life?
Well, I was officially born in Culver City, California, which is just a city up due to the fact that there wasn't a hospital in Venice. So I was born in Culver City, but raised in Venice Beach. So, you know, and as it's turned out, Venice really was a fantastic place to be while I was growing up. My family's still there. We had a lot of property there. I met my girlfriend at Venice High School. So in 1965, I was just 15, and Jim Morrison moved in right down the street on my street, Oceanfront Walk.
I lived at 29th
and Oceanfront. And he lived on 15th. So the Doors were born there, and there were many poets. There were coffee shops. The Gas House was down in there. It was like a bohemian lifestyle. Venice was kind of an odd duck, because originally designed to look like Venice, Italy, with the canals and all those structures, but it didn't take off, so that became more of the barrio. It was very much in demise. Cheap to live. The oceanfront property was high commodity. We lived there. I'll never forget my dad saying to me, you stay away from that dirty hippie. So Jim would walk along the beach. He'd walk along the beach every night just in leather pants and a guitar slung over his back. He'd sit, watch the horizon, and strum the guitar. So he'd say, you stay away from that dirty hippie. Of course I didn't.
Of course. I have my hand on my heart and, like, on my face. I can't even imagine.
Only Jim Morrison could get away with leather pants on a beach.
There you go. And so my girlfriend Kathy and I, we would follow him around. And Venice was such a poverty area. They would demolish some of the buildings, and they didn't have the money to put up a chain-link fence. So one day we're walking along, and they'd taken all the doors out of the house that they demolished, and they'd fashioned them together to make a fence. And right along those doors, Jim and the guys had come along and written the Doors of Perception. That was the first time I'd ever heard that, and we thought, oh, that's so cool.
Wow. You know,
And then they started going off into Hollywood and playing at, you know, London Fog. And we weren't old enough to go up there at that time, but they were born, you know, out of Venice.
Yeah, that is so cool. You got to kind of witness them come together and start to build what we know.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And I would have never, I mean, looking back on it now, and I used to be embarrassed to tell people I lived in Venice because it was such a kind of a train wreck place and a little bit dangerous. We had a big rehab center called Synanon. It was famous for having to rehabilitate heroin addicts. So I didn't want to tell people I lived there, but now I look back and think, yeah, it was actually kind of cool.
Yeah, lots of different types of characters around, I'm sure.
Yes.
So when did you start going to shows, and what music was driving you as a kid?
It was actually the Young Rascals. Well, they're not young anymore, but they were called the Young Rascals. They were Kathy and I just loved that band, and we found out they were playing at this new club called the Whiskey A Go Go. we were at Venice High, and we were in I think it was history class, kind of scribbled. I even have the folder scribbled, you know, doing their autographs on it. Realized, you know, I looked at her, she looked at me. We got up and left and drove up there.
Nice. Yep.
That was our first encounter, and we thought, oh my God, this place, look at all these bands, look at this equipment. Well, it got better because we waited and we watched the band walk back to a hotel and we followed. So that was it.
I love that. I love just picturing you just watching,
yeah,
just waiting, waiting for your opportunity. And then following.
Yeah.
Well, then we realized the hotel. Are you kidding me? They're staying here. We could stay here. We could hang out here.
If only it were like that still, you know? My goodness.
Well, to some degree it is, but, you know, not quite like it was back then. They were much easier to get to back then. But I think that the poor rascals, after a while, thought we were stalkers. We were showing up at the hotel and calling. I'll never forget calling and leaving a message. This is when I first learned my skill. Called and left a message for Gene Cornish. He called me back. He invited me to the hotel.
They loved it. You know, they were getting off on it.
But he opens the door and there's a 15-year-old staring him in the face. It's like, oh, darn.
On second thought.
But that band was actually quite good to us. They enjoyed us, but when we were at the hotel, they'd keep the door open. That was a big
good.
No-no.
Can't have a
little girl in there.
Yeah. That's actually a nice story to hear.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of being 15, can you tell us about meeting Keith Richards when you were that age?
In 1965, I was lucky enough to meet a girl in school who also loved the Rolling Stones, and she'd not seen them before as I had, so I invited her to go see them with me at the Los Angeles Sports Arena, and it turned out that her father was the general manager of the facility. They took me.
Wow. Oh, yes,
so
that's right.
We had these great seats, and after the show, we stayed backstage till her father closed up the arena. It was actually when we saw them in the flesh and we saw the tour bus pull in, it was just a brief encounter, but it was actually, I think it was Keith that just asked us, little girl, you want to come on the bus? I was like, yeah, I do. That wasn't happening. So I didn't get to go. I'd had an encounter where I crawled under the stage curtain at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. When the Stones had played, I went to that performance and picked up Keith's cigarette butt and carried that around with me for quite a while. That was about my only encounter with Keith.
Aww. It's cute hearing stories, like teenage stories of, you know, becoming a fan, a groupie, and all the, you know, silly kind of things that you do. But at the time, like, it's just so special. Like, you want that little cigarette butt, you know, his lips touched them, you know?
Yes.
I carried
that around with me for many years.
I work at a music venue, and one of the craziest experiences I've ever witnessed was a teenage girl literally licking the stage after a performance. That's a little extra.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
But,
there you go.
You know, when you're a fan, I guess, right?
Definitely. You want every bit of essence. You're breathing their air. You want to lick that stage where their feet have been. Yeah. I get it.
Yeah. Well, we were reading your chapter in Let's Spend the Night Together. We really loved how you used the term groupie as a verb. You groupied with this band. That was just such a cool thing. We were wondering if you could tell us about some of your other more memorable moments, experiences, relationships, and you've probably seen so many amazing shows at the Whiskey. Are there any specific ones that really stand out to you?
Well, actually, that term groupied with is Pamela DeBar's brainchild. That's her saying.
Oh.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Pamela DeBar. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Oh, Pamela. Yep. Oh, Miss P. Yeah, because we hadn't really heard it used in that context. And, you know, it is interesting sometimes where we will speak to women who describe, you know, things that they've done or relationships that they've had that we would 100% put under the category of being a groupie or having groupied, but they still don't call it that, or they've disassociated themselves with that term. But what do you think about the term? And then, yeah, again, if you could just tell us some of those memorable
moments.
We want to
hear more stories, Dee Dee.
Yeah.
well, you know, the term groupie came about as the time that I was hanging around in Venice. And I mean, it started coming up. My dad started laughing about it. I don't think the meaning now is the same as what it meant then. It used to just mean girls that would hang around bands, but now it's turned into something, I don't know, in my opinion, not as cute as it used to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you Google it, you'll see what I mean. But, you know, as far as memorable moments as a groupie, I have so many, but I think my most favorite magical time and a genuine connection that I made that was totally unexpected was my time with Jeff Beck.
Amazing.
My time with him, he actually wanted to take me back home to be with he and his girlfriend.
Wow.
Which I thought was really odd. But he kept saying, oh, she'd love you. I thought, okay.
Interesting.
Well, it's kind of funny hanging around with your favorite rock stars and the little tricks they had in their bags for, you know, meeting these guys. And I always had my own routine that I think worked like a charm. And my go-to was to single out one of the guys and get cozy with their closest friend instead of the guy I was after.
That's an interesting angle.
It's what I did. And I'd actually call the hotel when I knew they were in town and leave a message. And they always called back, which was really funny.
Pre-cell phones.
Yeah, back then we didn't have cell phones. Yeah. It was all landlines. But I also thought, you know, I'm not going to mess around. I just walked straight up to the guy that I like and put my arm through his and say, I'm your date for the night. They'd always say, okay.
I just love that. I love your confidence. That's the best.
I think that's what it's all about, is right place, right time, right attitude.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I agree 100%.
And Jeff Beck is amazing.
You
got to
grab what you want in life.
He's such an amazing guitarist and had such a great haircut, too.
He had an amazing look. Just a really, really fun, good-hearted guy. Absolutely loved cars. I think he's still into cars, but I knew this. I had tricks. My bag of tricks told me that he liked cars. So when I first met him, I drove my 69 purple Cougar. He wanted to drive the car.
That's
he did. He
tells
me because he'd ride up and he says to me, where are the keys?
Did you let him drive it?
Absolutely.
Amazing. You mentioned remembering what you wore when meeting certain rock stars, which we've noticed seems to have happened quite often in memoirs that we've read from women who either still own the pieces that they were wearing or they made the pieces that they were wearing. And it seems that it's quite intertwined. What is it about clothing that plays such a part in rock and roll romance and bringing back those memories?
You know, Pamela DeBar was surprised when I remembered some of her outfits. She didn't even remember them. I would tell her in detail, and she'd say, oh, yeah. But I think all the girls had their own style. Each tried to be a little bit more outrageous than the other in order to stand out and be noticed. In the late 60s, maybe into the early 70s, my group of girls shopped at a used clothing store that was called the Glass Farmhouse. It was way, way up on Sunset. They had these beautiful classic movie star dresses. They were made of satin and velvet, chiffon, silk. They were all from the 30s and 40s. We used to get those and cut them up into minis. They were very see-through, made for a most dramatic entrance. One of my favorite memories is wearing these teeny little satin or silk bed jackets. They were popular in the 30s. If you Google a bed jacket, you'll see what I mean. But they only covered just your top and a little tiny bow at the top. So we'd parade down Sunset in jean shorts, tall boots, and these little bed jackets. But since they were just tied together at the top, they'd fly open when the breeze gave way. And we gave quite a peep show and got a lot of attention. I think they were actually designed to allure rather than for warmth. Not sounds much like there. It. Yeah. I was a tomboy, so fashion really wasn't easy for me. The girls used to dress me. I love the styles of the 60s. Many of my outfits involve velvet. Nice. In fact, I remember a purple velvet cape the night I met Cozy Powell. And so I have a lot of memories, good memories recounting certain outfits. That kind of goes hand in hand. That goes hand in hand with remembering a special time for me.
Yeah, it's like remembering a song when, you know, it takes you back to a moment. I guess clothing can definitely do that as well.
Well, yeah, I remember
exactly. The
dress that I wore for Bob Dylan, because you take time to choose it. You're like, well, if he's looking at me, I want to look like this. Yeah. And I remember what I wore the night I met Josh Tillman, and now I look at it and I'm like, why would I ever have worn that? But I do keep it tucked away in like a special bin, and I'll take it out from time to time and go, ah.
I think that's also why the rock stars.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's also why the rock stars were so attracted to you and Miss P and the GTOs and everything. Inspiration beyond it was like, again, it's not just about sex. It's about meeting interesting, fantastic people that you can learn from, or you know, get something out of them that you want. And I feel like so many rock stars took their image from the women that they were hanging out with.
I completely agree. I really do. I mean, we used to jump in whenever our guys would come to town, and we'd step into a domesticated role, like doing their laundry, mending their clothes. They'd often see our stuff and want to wear it. And then that role extended into fellow band members. It was kind of like a family setting. They inspired us. We inspired them.
Exactly what it was. It was that symbiotic relationship. There was give and get. And I feel like at this point, you know, we've been doing this podcast for 3 years now. We're going into our fourth. And at this point, we're not really convincing anybody anymore about like trying to
even, right?
We were maybe a bit defensive at first when we began, being like, look, being this, like having this role in rock and roll history is super important, and this is why. And I think, you know, we've certainly proved it over the years by having these really wonderful conversations. But I think the narrative of like all of the women were exploited, this was wrong, it's all about sex, like I think it's pretty clear that that's not what this was. Yeah. And I'm happy that we've gotten there.
Yeah, not at all. And a lot of us were known as a certain guy's LA girl. So, I mean, we knew when they left L.A., they were going to go on to another town and be with somebody else. But for L.A., I would know I was this guy's L.A. girl. Whenever they came to town, then I would step into my domesticated role, doing the laundry, mending the clothes, that kind of thing. It you know, and it extended out. But we had our area, and we had our title, and we had our guy. And that was what we looked forward to, the next tour.
Well, that's pretty cool and open-minded and progressive to say, I'm the LA girl and all good. Like, you're going on to your next town and you'll be with that girl. And then this guy's going to come to town and I'll be with him and I'll see you next time. Where did that develop? Like, because I imagine you probably didn't see that much at home, but where did that consciousness come from? Is it just that it was because it was the 70s?
I just remember liking a guy. He'd come into town. I'd want him. I didn't want him going around with everybody else. So I got to where I'd say, well, am I your LA girl? And it just sort of came about like that. Everybody would kind of stake their claim. The other girls would know, don't even go near him. Mm. He's mine.
Yeah.
And that's how it worked. And everybody would kind of live together. They'd come, we'd do the laundry. It was like a little coming home to your wife in every town. I don't know. It didn't seem to bother anybody. I was content to be someone's LA girl. Hey, as soon as he left, another one was coming.
Yeah.
It was all good.
And It's not like you have to deal with the things that come along with, you know, living with someone in like a real relationship. You get to have all the fun, and it's always, you know, exciting, and getting to miss someone is so nice. And yeah, it's like kind of a perfect relationship there.
Well, when you think about it, all people have multiple relationships and romances in a lifetime. Mine just happened to be with some well-known people, and you know, they'd come into town and it'd be like, okay, it's my turn. I was okay with it. We were all drinking from the same water hole near our village. So, you know, mine happened to be the Hollywood and the whiskey where the band stopped daily. So that was my world. And I found my love interest in that place. They'd come, they'd go. Yeah. But there was always somebody there and always something fun happening.
Awesome. How has being a band lover brought you feelings of empowerment?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know that I'd call it empowerment. It was just a lifestyle, really.
Okay. Yeah. Have you ever encountered scenarios where you have felt uncomfortable with what you were asked to do or anything that you've seen?
No, I avoided. I made sure that I cozied up with the right people. I never got mistreated. For instance, I spent a lot of time in the Led Zeppelin camp.
Yeah.
My roommate was going out with, I'm trying to think of his name, Richard Cole. He was the road manager. I went along for the ride, and then I remember him saying, stay close, and I was just at odd ends. So, you know, I watched the guys doing all kinds of horrible things to these girls. I thought, well, I better get in there too. So I chose to grab on to Peter Grant, their manager. Well, that was it. Nobody touched me after that. And I had a very, very nice relationship going in the Led Zeppelin camp due to that.
You talked about your friend earlier that you were in high school with, and you guys went out to shows and everything. Did you have like your little clique of girlfriends that you would always go to these shows with and that, you know, were like-minded and picking out the rock stars? And
well, we all worked at the Whiskey. So there was a ticket taker, a ticket seller, and a waitress, and me, and we all shared a house, and we ended up sharing a house that was just a block down from the Whiskey. So it was like a little family, and we'd have the bands over there, and you know, just good times.
What a perfect setup.
That was pretty good, yeah.
When I was in university, I lived in a full house with three other girls, and yeah, it was certainly the party house. And it was after a show, a lot of the times the bands would come into town and they wouldn't have, like, there was no Airbnb and they didn't really want to pay for a hotel, so they would show up just hoping that somebody would offer them a floor. And a lot of the times we were the girls saying, we've got a house, we've got space, we've got couches, we got floors. And sometimes, like, we've got beds. Yeah. So that was such a fun time. Like I remember those times so fondly. It was almost so carefree and so, yeah, just we were enjoyable. The welcoming committee, you know, yeah, exactly. I loved it.
Exactly. Right. I mean, we had our house and we all had multiple relationships and romances in a lifetime. Ours just happened to be with well-known people. Mm-hmm. We were working and living close to the club. So, you know, I think everybody drinks from their own water hole near their village. So ours happened to be the whiskey in Hollywood. Coincidentally, bands stopped there daily. So that was our world. And we found our relationships and our love interests in that place.
Did you ever, with your girlfriends, kind of want the same guy, and how did you deal with that?
I had that problem with the Hollies. It was funny. At the whiskey, we get in a bunch of new albums. The record companies would send us albums, and the girls that come up to visit during the day, especially when my boss went home, when Elmer Valentine left, and then they pull out the albums and they start pointing, I want him, and I want him, and I want him, and I'm thinking, oh boy, okie dokie, you know, here we go. I just kind of navigated around him. I went back to my old go-to of calling the hotel. Yes. Give me a call. And yeah, I got in trouble a lot doing that.
Well, it worked.
It worked. The girls didn't like it.
We were mentioning that once you were finished, or you kind of gave up the position at the whiskey, because you traveled the world with your ex-husband, well, your husband at the time, or your boyfriend at the time, Ron Keel. So can you tell us what it was like touring all over with Motley Crue, Kiss, Bon Jovi? Did you like touring?
Well, Keel never toured with Kiss, but Gene Simmons did produce a couple of albums. So I spent a lot of time in the recording studios with both Gene and Paul Stanley of Kiss. Kiss was also recording at the time, so we were in New York City at Electric Lady for a while. I got to know them pretty well.
Gotcha.
And there were only two Motley Crue shows that Keel did, because Nikki Sixx gave me that favor for having helped his band get started in Hollywood.
Amazing.
The touring life was extremely tiring and tedious, and I got to where I didn't like it. We did three dates with Bon Jovi at Madison Square Garden. Those were kind of a highlight for me, though I was pregnant at the time. Other than that, Keel did tours with Queensryche and Dio, Helix, Accept, Loudness, kind of little small tours where they were all grouped together. Day-to-day travel from town to town and country to country, they all began to look alike. There was like no sense of day or night, really no enjoyment in sightseeing or, you know, anything like that. It was just crazy nights, show after show and party after party, until I couldn't do it anymore. So I actually left a couple of tours after maybe 2 weeks. I literally had the bus driver drive to the airport and drop me off, and I caught the next flight home.
Wow. Yeah, I think people don't realize like just how grueling touring is. And yeah, it's just like venue, bus.
Yeah.
You're not, you know, getting to see the cities and...
No, not at all. There's no time, and you're often leaving in the middle of the night, and you know it's pretty crazy. It's too much after a while.
Yeah, and then if you are like a party band like Motley Crue, for instance, like it, no wonder it took such a toll on them at the time. Like that's a hard enough lifestyle, even if you are very young. But
right, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a part of rock and roll and the lifestyle that has been glamorized a little bit. And so I think that maybe a lot of people or like women who dream about what it's like to be on tour maybe are nostalgic or want to be nostalgic for something that isn't really real, I guess.
Yeah, it's not like Almost Famous just having a group sing along on the bus and everything's hunky-dory always, yeah.
No, that's always romanticized. I mean, the day-to-day life, I mean, people say to me, oh my God, you worked at the whiskey. That's, well, you know, every day wasn't just a fun day. A lot of days were just like working in an office, but, you know, just like being on the road. You know, you look back on it and think, wow, how did I survive that?
Yeah.
It's really bad, but But, you know, you pick out the bits and pieces and string them together. And it's a pretty incredible lifestyle when you look at it from that point of view.
Mm-hmm. Well, with all of these little bits and pieces and these wonderful memories, have you ever thought about writing a memoir of your own?
I am actually in the middle of memoir writing classes with a wonderful author named Chris Epting.
Amazing.
And so I have a notebook. I didn't think that I really had stories, but I actually have a big fat notebook, and he tells me, "You have a book."
Yeah, you do.
And so every Monday night I go and write another thought that ends up becoming more of a chapter. So yeah, it's coming along, and it's kind of fun to walk back and remember. And I find the correlating photographs from my boxes, and it's quite horrifying.
Oh.
So we'll see how that goes. But he seems to think I have a book, so I'm just going to keep going along.
Oh, that we love hearing that. It's so exciting knowing there's something more down the line. We get to hear more stories and everything. I wanted to ask, judging by your Facebook, you're still very much involved in, you know, live music. You go out to shows all the time. Clearly still a very important part of your life. I was curious, do you keep in touch with a lot of your old rock and roll chums? And what bands can you not resist if they are touring? Like, who do you have to see?
Well, I'm in constant contact with many of the people that I worked with at the Whiskey and the Roxy, well, even the Rainbow, and a lot of my former boyfriends from bands. Now, I recently got to reunite with Ian Pace from Deep Purple, so that was really exciting for me. A lot of my relationships are decades old. It kind of creates a common bond. It's hard to break that when you have that kind of history.
Yeah.
So I look forward to seeing a lot of them when they come into town. Oh, as far as who can I not resist seeing? It's a little funny. I can always have to go see The Sweet, even though I had no common bond with them back in the day. Absolutely adore The Sweet. Another one, Ronnie Spector. Another one.
Cool.
Can't resist. And of course, Adam Ant.
He was just at my work recently.
Go-tos.
Yeah. He just played.
Yeah, every year I have my annual Adam Ant tour, and now that I have a really good friend who's their flight road manager, we'll be going on my Adam Ant tour this year coming up here in April. So excited to see him.
Amazing. You go out pretty often to shows? It seems like you're always out. Like I see photos of you backstage hanging out with your girlfriends. Yeah,
I do. I do. I love music. I love going to concerts. As long as I can still move about and get in the front row and get a backstage pass, I'm in.
Yes.
I think that just became the little sound bite.
The little sound
taking
wave.
That quote. Oh, that's so wonderful. Can you tell us about your monthly radio spot?
Well, that's kind of funny because I've never done radio. And I had a friend from a band who said, "I'm doing this radio program. It's out of somewhere near Chicago. It's actually got a tower." I'm thinking, okay, it's a real radio station. I was kind of hesitant at first, but I thought, okay, I'll do it. And so I did one. It turned out they loved my stories, and they decided to make me part of the show once a month. So my official title is Rock Zone Reporter.
Oh, say that one more time.
On here. My official title is Rock Zone Reporter.
Cool.
For WDJLFM, Radio's Rock Station. You know what's cool about it, though, is one of the DJs is one of the members of Procol Harum. So that can't be bad.
Amazing.
Yeah. Good. Good. That's a great one. So, well, you've got a great voice. You've got the stories. You've got the charisma. I think, I don't know, there's something opening up, just, you know, saying, the world needs more Dee Dee.
Yes.
Oh, well, thank you.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention before we kind of wrap up here? This has been so amazing. Thank you for talking to us and sharing. And
yeah, anything else you want to talk about? Like what you're up to or what's bringing you joy these days or anywhere if you want people to go and follow you online, whatever.
Well, no, I think in life we all have a couple of roads to walk. One is always the sensible way, and the other is our passion. So I learned at a young age to walk them both very carefully so I could have it all. So going all the way in one direction or the other never seems to have a happy ending. Hmm. Now, I've gone off-road a few times in my life, but I've always gotten back on track. I've fulfilled many dreams, in fact, more than I ever dreamed I would. I have no regrets, and my memory book is packed. So I think as long as you are sensible about where you're going in life, but you always keep your fun path open and you can walk both sides of the road, I think you're going to have a full memory book at the end of your life and have no regrets.
Dee Dee, that was incredible. Thank you so much. And you're right. That's great advice.
Yeah, I think as we enter this like new decade and taking stock, I just I turned 32 yesterday, and I've been really thinking about, like you said, like it almost feels like we've lived many lives in this one life and having these like many relationships. And I'm so grateful for that. And you're right. Like it's so nice to not maybe go 100% in one way, but try this, go here, do this, have an open mind, have an open heart, and just truly drink in this beautiful life.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, it's funny. Everybody gets a lot of giggles out of it. I'm actually 69 years old.
Yeah, girl.
It's the naughty number. You gotta love that one.
Oh, love it. Good for you. And yeah, I don't know what this thing about, you know, women or back in, I don't know, whenever, like, oh, I don't want to say my age, or I'm not, like, good for you. Yeah. We should all be celebrating all of the years that we've lived and learning from one another. And, you know, I'm sure that there's girls, like, I know that we have 19-year-old listeners that are like, great. And then they can look to us and they can look to you. And we're all just, like, learning from one another and sharing our stories. And I think that brings me empowerment.
Absolutely, yeah.
I agree 100%. Yes. Yes. Live your life, but live it sensibly, but live it in a fun way. Just go where your passion takes you. Just Amazing. Do it sensibly.
Thank you Perfect. So much, Dee Dee. We can't wait to meet you and have some fun in LA.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. We're going to have to put on our hippie clothes and hitchhike up the canyon. I plan to do that with you.
Absolutely.
You're the one. You're the one that we're going to do it with. Can't think of anybody better to do that kind of little adventure with. So that will be an absolute dream. And thank you. Thank you for opening up to us and allowing us to celebrate you here on our podcast. And it sounds like you've got some really fantastic things happening right now and in the future. So we love hearing that.
Well, thank you very much, girls. I love you. Talk to you later.
We love you, too. And we will talk to you very soon.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Dee Dee.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nail, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.